Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Man, you guys, I just imagine your family just like, just connected to machines. You guys are like the future right now. It's pretty wild.
I gotta say, we're burning. I mean, it's funny for like all the sort of the technical issues we've had with some of our guests. Like, we're getting some serious mileage out of some old fucking computers over here, dude. My son is doing all his schooling on like, a Mac Mini, which I think is from like 2007.
That's awesome.
And then my wife had a laptop from 2009 that was freaking doing great until he dumped a sweet iced tea into it.
The iced tea incident.
Keeping with the broken...
It was a sweet tea.
Yeah, it had milk and tons of sugar, so it was like there was no coming back from it, dude.
Even worse, yeah. That's the worst. You know, before the thing happened, he who may not be said, I basically go to the gym in order, like, I literally pay for the gym and go to the gym to have an excuse to go into the sauna. Like, that's literally, like, why I do it. I'll be, like, on a fucking rowing machine. I'll be like, this fucking sucks. Like, how long does it take before I can go in there? But one thing I noticed, like, the young kids, like, younger people walk in there and they're fucking with their phones.
Right.
They literally use their phones in the sauna now.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, when you go to the Apple store, the one thing they'll never, never, ever give you back is water damage. Like, I would never bring my phone into a locker room. It's crazy.
But the new phones are waterproof.
Fuck you. What else are you going to tell me? That's bullshit.
I don't trust it.
You know what I've been mad about a little bit? I don't know if you've heard about this Last Dance documentary. You know, this big... basically the last year of the Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Phil Jackson Bulls.
Right.
They basically knew they had 1 year left as this group. It was their final championship run, and they had given unprecedented access that season, but Michael Jordan had been shelving the footage up until now. They finally put it together, and it's this big deal, a 10-part documentary series that's come out. All that being said, I don't want to get into it too much. This is going off track. But I've been really offended by like people's sort of revisionist history on Dennis Rodman. I'd be curious, like someone like you who wasn't really that into sports but knows pop culture, like,
oh, yeah, Rodman.
What do you like Rodman? Did you like him?
Yeah, I liked him. And he was the first, unless you go all the way back to Joe Namath.
Right.
There was nobody between those two who was actually like, that I can recall, who was like a big athlete, a successful athlete, but also like an amazing like pop culture icon.
Exactly. He's glam as fuck. And, I feel like I've been listening, you know, maybe it's where I disconnect from my brethren in the sports world. But it's like I'm listening to all these guys with just like shitty beards and blue jeans and t-shirts sitting there being like, yeah, I think it was disingenuous. And he was just trying to, you know, show and like get attention. I'm like, motherfucker, you guys are norms.
Yeah.
You know, like you're norms. You don't get this shit. You don't understand just that need to be different. You don't even care how you get it. You know what I mean? You just like need to be independent. And when you're in such a cookie cutter, whitewashed sort of world, like professional sports, where like you're literally not supposed to say anything. You know, there's literally never been an openly gay athlete in any of the four sports. And you had this guy jacked like hell, 6'9", 240 pounds, you know what I mean? Like, right. Like wearing dresses, marrying himself, you know, like wearing makeup, being super glam, just doing whatever the fuck he wanted and kind of bringing this like cool alternative element to sports that I do think like freaks norms out.
Oh, yeah.
And even after like 20 years, you hear these like sportscasters who, even the ones who like think they're alternative, and then you're like, oh, okay, right. You're just some fucking norm. You don't get it.
Right, right.
But I like him. I still like him. Yeah. What a fucking, what a weirdo.
You can only be the rock star if you can bring it. And he could bring it. So he brought it. And not just on the, in the game, but like, he was fucking hilarious. Like, his whole deal was creative and original. It was fun to watch, man.
Even someone was texting me. They're like, yeah, but what about the whole like, Carmen Electra and like Madonna thing, and I'm like, what?
Where else you gonna go, man? What is,
I'm like, that's. Are you talking? Yeah, are you talking about this guy being unquantifiably fucking awesome or something else? Because I don't even understand your point. You know,
yeah, like, that's royalty. That is fucking royalty right there. That guy went
from being homeless at the end of high school to playing for like Southern Oklahoma State University. To dating Madonna within like 5 years. That's a good jump.
Yeah.
I respect a person like that. That takes moxie.
And I mean, obviously everybody knows Madonna, but like, you know, there was, before Beyonce, there was Madonna. Like,
that's right.
If you don't realize how big Madonna was, there was like, you know, there was year zero, then there was Elvis Presley, then there was Madonna.
You know? Wait, we're not giving Tina Turner any love in there?
No, she's fantastic, but she was not at that level. I mean, Madonna owned everything, you know?
Yeah, and also style icon, culture icon, the whole
film
deal.
Like everything. She was bigger than I think people realize. I mean, I dare say she was bigger than like Beyonce for sure. Maybe not bigger than the couple combined.
But could you see Beyonce playing shortstop for the Rockford Peaches in a league of their own? I certainly couldn't. All the way May. I love that character.
Wait for the reboot.
So what's funny about what we're talking about is we interviewed Frank Turner, who's English, and the lion's share of people who just listened to the last 10 minutes of what we said probably have no fucking idea what we're talking about.
Oh, come on. They know Madonna. She had a British accent. We talk about the British accent. Remember, she rocked it for a while.
That's true. Oh, yeah, that's true. That's a tie-in. That's pretty good.
She fits right in with that.
Yeah, this was a great interview. We had old friend and touring buddy Frank Turner on the horn with us from his disease-ridden neighborhood, just like everywhere in the world, in his house. And gave us an awesome chat, man. I really loved getting into it with Frank.
I love your war stories with him, dude. That's the kind of shit I can just sit back and listen to.
That's one thing. Like, you know, I won't get into it. We didn't get into it on the podcast. But, you know, with success, there's always some people who have fucking something to say, you know? And Frank took some shit along the way. He's had barbs thrown at him for a number of things. If there's one thing I can really get behind that guy about, I saw him at the Ground Up, and I saw him when he was really starting to build his solo career. And that was a focused, hardworking motherfucker who was willing to go anywhere in the world with his guitar and play his songs. Right. You know, that guy would get on a fucking train and head to like Israel and Palestine just with his guitar pretending to be a tourist, you know, and seriously, yeah. You know, and things that were like, I think he knew it. That's where he came out of the hardcore scene, and he's a smart guy. And I think he knew if you want that love and you want that credibility, you got to drag yourself for a while, you know, and you got to work for it, and you got to do it, and you got to let everyone see it. I think he was always smart about that. And you can't take that away from someone.
Yeah.
You can never devalue someone else's hard work, you know?
Yeah, my famous line, any time I talk to like a young artist or band, I'm like, I think that most upcoming artists or wannabes think that there is talent, luck, and hard work. And I think that commonly they think you pick two of those.
Right.
That if you can master two of those, then you can get famous, you can have a successful career. But the truth is, I've never met anybody that didn't have all three. There's a you know, there's very few, there's one or two maybe that you can hold up and say, what about so and like, but for the most part, you got to do all three.
I think, yeah, to an extent, you have to have some. I definitely think I would lean more towards luck and hard work, for sure.
Come on, dude. You're talented as fuck, Benny.
No, stop it. No, this wasn't a reach. This wasn't a reach for maybe it was. Feed me. Feed me. I need it. I need it. I'm trapped in a house. You know that. Little kids, they don't... You could make them the most beautiful meal, takes an hour, you know, and they just walk up to the table and throw it in your face and go do something else. You know, very unappreciative. It's easy to lose your confidence with little kids,
oh, yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. The parent fail.
But anyway, Frank was smart. He didn't make those, so he gets to still cruise wherever he wants. But yeah, I really enjoyed this interview, especially getting into... You know, our time trapped in Sweden together, which was a really interesting week. One of those like flashbulb memory touring weeks. Like for some reason, the things inside of that week are super clear and illuminated. It was like one of those really interesting turning point kinds of times. And I'm glad that Frank was there with me. And that thing I brought up in the interview, I know I said it in passing, but I was in kind of I was having a bad night. The one night that Frank and I wound up in a hotel room by ourselves, drinking a bottle of wine and having a good human conversation. And I really did appreciate it. It was, you know, when you tour with people, you know, there's sometimes like the tour person and the regular person, and you kind of got to, eventually, you know someone long enough and they meet in the middle, right. You know? But I really value those real moments when you just find another person and get to be raw with them.
Yeah,
you know?
No, that's immense, dude.
I love it. So, without further ado, let's listen to it.
It's going on track!
Very
okay,
good.
Great.
Excellent.
Hey,
I'm just gonna close
hey
the door.
Frank.
Hey, buddy, how are you?
Oh, you know... Just hanging out.
It's like, I've been saying to people, it's a bit like the first couple of days after you get back from tour forever.
It's just
it's like we just got back and it's like, it constantly feels like tour ended 2 days ago, or at least if you can convince yourself of that, then it feels less awful.
Well, there's a strange part of it. I've been thinking that people of our ilk are just kind of better suited for it in general because of the... You know, either the self-caused disruption that we give our own lives, or the disruption that, you know, the lifestyle itself lends to us, kind of goes part and parcel for what we're doing, which is...
Well, yeah. I mean, there's that whole thing of essentially just getting used to just making do with whatever life throws at you, which is, I think, one of the main things that touring life has taught me is it's just like something happens and you just have to adapt to it immediately. Do you know what I mean? There's no point in pissing your pants and crying about it. It's happened. Get on with it. Do you know what I mean?
That was my biggest thing. Getting accustomed to being a full-time touring musician was, acquiescing control. Was essentially like one of the first things I had to give up. Just understanding that there's moving parts at work that have nothing to do with you and you can't control, and you'll drive yourself crazy trying to do it.
Yeah. Just fucking sit tight and wait until it's your turn to do something.
That's right. Yeah. So do you have I kind of have like a flashbulb moment when I realized this was something to be concerned about, to like, oh shit, this is a fucking thing. Like, do you have a specific moment when you kind of really ingested it that way?
Well, the thing for me that was weird and led to one of the weirdest 4-day sections of my life ever was that I was on tour in the UK. I was doing a solo tour, and it was me and my wife, Jess, was on tour. And do you know Micah Schnabel from Two Cow Garage?
I know the band, don't know him personally.
Yeah, yeah. So Mike is awesome, and his wife, Vanessa Jean Speckman, partner, I should say, Vanessa Jean Speckman. So those two were on the tour as well, and we were just having the best time. You know, we were playing kind of like 1,500 caps around the UK, solo shows, really cool atmosphere, everyone having a great time. And the news had been coming through, you know, from China, and then it was in Italy. And I was still a bit on the whole kind of like, you know, SARS and bird flu and swine flu wasn't big a deal. It'll be fine kind of vibe. And then we were in the middle of this tour and we had a day off. And on the day off, the government did in the UK did a press conference in which they said, basically, this is going to be bad, but we're not bringing in any like government enforced restrictions or anything right now. But it's probably a good idea not to gather in large numbers. And we were like, what the fuck, man? What are we supposed to do with that information? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's right,
like,
right.
We've told us that we can do gigs, but that it's probably a bad idea to do gigs. So we had that day, and then we had three show days. And the first, all those 3 days, I spent the entire day on the phone with my manager and my agent and having phone conferences and talking to my tour manager. You know how it is, just sat in the production office all day discussing the morality and the merits and the technicalities and all the rest of it.
Yeah, sure.
And the first two shows, we were both like 1,500 cap venues. They were both sold out and everybody showed up. We had people clicking people in because I wanted to see, like, you know, is there a significant proportion of people not coming? And people did come. And, you know, the atmosphere was amazing. And I, you know, obviously on the one hand, I don't want to do something that contributes to things getting worse. But at the same time, this is what I do. I've got a contract with the promoter and with the venue and indeed with every ticket holder, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's a tricky situation. What date was this about?
This was, I can answer that question if you give me a minute by looking at my calendar. This was about the kind of middle of March, about the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th of March. And then, so we did Bath and then we did Aylesbury. And then the third show was at Southend. And by that point, the kind of conversation in this country, particularly online, had really shifted. And people were getting really pissy about everything and like scared and angry. And I was getting a ton of grief on social media for continuing with the shows, and you know, people being like, "Oh, you're a murderer."
Oh,
and
it's okay.
Really, dude? And then at that third show, the three in Southend, we had about 50% attendance versus tickets sold.
So.
And with no disrespect to anyone in Southend, the vibe in the room was a little bit like Last Call in a bar. Do you know what I mean? The kind of people you have to kick out of a bar. It didn't feel good anymore. And I came off stage that night and I said to Tree, my tour manager, I was like, we're done here. We need to go home.
Then
funnily enough, the following day, the government announced actual lockdown.
Right. Yeah. It seemed like a strange trickle-down progression that everybody had to go through. I mean, I'm about as paranoid as it gets. You know, as much as like a doomsday prepper that a guy who lives in a city could be, and
sure.
You know, it was hard. Like, we're both living in countries currently where the information getting fed to us from the top too is awfully confusing and usually tied to other things that benefit the people saying it or not.
Sure.
And it's hard to come to a hard conclusion, especially when you're in a position to, I mean, it's not like lives are on the line because of you specifically,
right?
But you are in a strange position of forging ahead or not. Yeah.
Man, you know, what you and I have spent the last two decades of our lives doing is making a living out of traveling and gathering people together in crowded rooms, which are the two things that we're not now allowed to do.
I know.
So it's a fuck time. The one thing I would say, and I mean, I'm speaking more to the UK right now because obviously you guys have your own issues, should we say, he said politely.
What's that?
Well, you know, drinking bleach and all that shit. But like, there are a lot of people in this country. Let me phrase this right. One of the things I think that this whole situation has highlighted is there's a lot of people who've made it their business to be furious and outraged about something 24 hours a day, regardless of what the world is actually doing. And the problem with that approach to life is that it leaves you nowhere to go when genuinely bad things actually happen.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? If you're constantly furious when things are kind of okay, and I'm not, again, I'm talking, this applies differently to different parts of the world for obvious reasons, but like, you know, there's a bunch of people who are now furious at every single thing that our government does because it's a Tory government. And I didn't vote for this government. And I understand that some people don't like them extremely and all the rest of it. And that's legitimate. But it's like, there is a part of me that's like, guys, this has never happened before in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's like the expectation that any government anywhere with the best will in the world is just going to land it first time around is kind of unrealistic. I mean, and you know, one can look at, there's a big debate about what's happening in Sweden. There's a lot of people talking about how New Zealand have handled it well, and good for them, you know, but it's like the idea that like the decision, in the same way that the decision for me to pull the tour wasn't nearly as easy as some people on social media wanted it to be.
Right. So,
I mean, they were like, oh, dude, just cancel the tour. And I'm like, cool. Yeah. Cause that's just a simple thing.
Yeah.
To
it's
do.
Like, I don't have like a pre-existing contract with every single place I'm about to play. There's been money exchanged. There's a long, long complicated. I mean, I tried to explain that in another podcast too, where there's a reason you saw everybody delay their tours, right? Because, you know, at first you're desperately trying to hang on to that date. So you don't have to renege all these contracts and redeposit money and do all...
It's a complicated business.
Yeah, yeah. It's taxing on that level.
Yeah. But so on that level as well, I'm a bit kind of like, the decision by any government to introduce a shutdown that just kills the economy stone dead is not something that someone's going to be like, oh yeah, cool, that sounds like a good idea, flip the switch.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think the idea that people hesitated, that people were sort of like trying to figure out what the best things to do is not necessarily a sign that we're governed exclusively by bastards. I mean, I say all of this... you know, we yet to have a prime minister telling us to drink bleach. So,
I mean, I think the one thing you would at least expect, right? It's like, so I'm a nearly 40-year-old professional drummer who talks on podcasts and shit. Like, so when I'm opening up a report, I realize I'm not an epidemiologist, and I realize my scope. And I'd like to have the trust or the faith in the fact that the people who I voted for, the people I hired for the job, are better than me at this.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, someone such as myself going into a situation like that would just err on the side of caution if, like, lives were at stake. And I'm talking about a government, not you, you know?
I think
that's where the... You know, there's a few days, it seems, with most countries where there was like less of a boots on the ground, but more of a philosophical approach on what to do. Like, like there's a measured response that is probably smarter in the long run, but maybe a couple people are going to get sacrificed in the process.
Yeah.
And it's a strange ground. But like you said, it's never been done. So
Well, we had this very strange thing that happened over here, which really fucking ground my gears, that for a while at the beginning of the shutdown, the government's chief scientific officer and chief medical officer, who both strike me as reasonably together and honest and intelligent people, and they've been kind of leading the briefings over here, were talking about herd immunity. And it turned out to be a PR disaster. And the reason it was a PR disaster is that people are fucking morons, right? It's like, the bottom line is if you just think about it for a minute, that's how you get over any sort of new disease, is that you reach a certain point whereby enough members of the population have had it and have antibodies in the system. And this is a much more realistic and quicker and easier way than getting a vaccine or getting a cure and all this kind of thing. Or at least that is a valid scientific approach to the problem. But everybody kind of went, so you just want to kill everyone. And it turned into this sort of PR disaster. So they ended up rolling the whole thing back. And it just... One of the other things that I think this whole situation has highlighted, which is less good in terms of social media and the way that we interact with each other on social media, is that every fucker thinks that they're an instant expert on social media.
Yes.
And the small version of this for me is all the people who are tweeting me advice about how to run my fucking tour. And it's like, cool, I didn't realize that you had 20 years of experience in the live music industry. Do go on. Do you know what I mean? But similarly, it's like, you know, everybody is, it's like not all opinions are equal. My opinion is not equal to the chief scientific officer of the United Kingdom. Because I don't fucking know anything about epidemiology.
Yeah.
So, you know, and there's just an awful lot of people who they've sort of gotten used to social media being a place of validation. Do you know what I mean? And like, there's a big part of me that just wants to run around going, shut up just for 5 minutes, shut the fuck up.
Yes.
And that's not because I want to kill debate. I do think debate's important. And actually, there's a fair amount of scientific debate and lack of consensus about what we're doing.
Yes.
I think we need to get into all of that. But I'd like scientists to have that debate, please.
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think that's the issue right now is, people where do you get your information and where you do trust that information is maybe the biggest problem. But the one the one thing I keep thinking about in terms of social media, trying to spin it positively. You know me. I want to try to think of things a certain way. And, you know, even like I open up a new Malcolm Gladwell book yesterday, right? And and I'm reading about the lack of communication between Cortez when he landed on Mexico and the Aztecs essentially led to the death of 20 million Aztecs within not very long, you know? And one thing I always think about in approaches like that is if social media and some version of globalism exist at that point, there's another rational society somewhere else in the world that's like, no. Like, you probably shouldn't do that.
Absolutely.
That's not a good idea. And, and there is that aspect of social media. It's like, I think we're reeling in what exactly is the fuck is even happening with social media, you know, as far as...
Well, it's the communications revolution that is, I think, is equally as important as the industrial revolution. And again, it's not surprising that collectively as a species, we're kind of stumbling around in it. And I don't think that anyone's particularly to blame for that. And you know what? I'm, you know, me, I'm an optimist as well, generally speaking. And like, you know, a lot of people have made this comment, and I think it's a valid comment, is just to wonder what all of this would have been like if it had happened 20 years ago. I wouldn't be live streaming shows. I wouldn't be able to FaceTime my mom, you know, and like there's, in a way, we're very fortunate with all of the technology at our disposal right now in terms of the fact that it makes a lot of this easier, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, and then but people talk about the 1918, 1919 Spanish flu epidemic, and like it's definitely not that bad for various different reasons. But one of them, you know, it is actually quite easy or comparatively easy, not only to tell people, for the governments and scientists and whoever to like communicate information with people, but also for us to kind of exist. You know, I mean, I'm incredibly lucky. I live in a house that I like, that I have a little bit of outdoor space, and I have my wife and I have my cat, and, you know, I can talk to my mom. My mom actually figured out Zoom before I did, which was
there you go.
I know. My mom is in her 70s, and she was like, she sent me an invite to a Zoom meeting, and I was like, what the fuck is this?
That's hip.
Yeah. No, totally.
That's one of the funny parts about all this. You know, obviously, I've been tuning into like 1,000 of my friends' live streams and things that are going on. I'm enjoying watching what people choose as their home backdrop. did you give that any thought? Did you do some setup? Like what did you do for that?
Well, I mean, this was absolutely. I mean, the main thing from my point of view was more about damage limitation than about like image presentation. Kind of like, you know, is there any like
Nothing embarrassing,
nothing kind of that's going to like piss anybody off or start a conversation can't be asked with. Not like, that I feel like I have a lot of that lying around the house, but you know, you just want to be sure.
Yeah, what if you read Dianetics in the 90s out of curiosity? You don't want that sitting on the shelf, you know?
There's enough people watching that somebody somewhere is zooming in on the background. You know what I mean?
1,000%.
Yeah, completely. And then, I mean, also, so my wonderful and incredible wife, Jess, she was a bit more kind of like, we've got to tidy up, we've got to make it look nice, look presentable. So she took care of, she was right. I mean, we absolutely should. So she took care of the kind of like aesthetic values, should we say. And I was more on the sort of like political damage control side of things. But I mean, also it was a bit like, you know, we needed to do it in the room that's next to the router. That's pretty boring, but it's like, you know, you've got to have good connection and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
But yeah, you know, it's a funny thing because like prior to this lockdown, this is an interesting thing actually. Prior to this lockdown, like Jess and I have had a bit of a kind of rule about not like giving too much away about where we live. Do you know what I mean?
Sure,
just in terms of saving a little bit of privacy for ourselves. And we've become a lot laxer on that, you know, because of what's happening. And it's just like, it does kind of feel like I'm inviting everybody into my house once a week for the live streams that I'm doing. And, you know, we've kind of settled into that and used it out of necessity. But it's funny, like 2 months ago, I would have been a lot more uptight about people seeing, you know, the inside of my house, basically.
Yeah. Do you find yourself like enjoying it, or do you feel a little exposed?
You know, I'm getting used to it, I guess, is what I would say. I mean, one of the other things in terms of playing a live stream show is that it's at the beginning, it's fucking weird. You finish a song and aside from Jess clapping and the cat kind of giving me a funny look, right. Like very little happens. You know, and indeed there are parts of songs that you kind of get used to as a performer over the years, using the audience as part of the song, whether it's a clap along or a sing along or just drawing a section out or whatever it might be.
You're excellent at inciting a nice crowd sing along. I didn't even think of that.
You get to that point where you're like, sing it, and then nothing happens.
I think I have a solution for you right here. People are looking for new ways to make revenue, right? Maybe you host a Zoom meeting in conjunction with your performance where 12-tiered paying fans.
Like VIP tickets.
VIP tickets. They sit on an alternate laptop on a Zoom chat, and every time you finish, woo! You got 12 people ripping it.
Well,
but you might want to give that money to charity so you don't look like an asshole.
My buddy Sean McGowan, who's a great, great songwriter from the UK, he did this wonderful thing. He had a sound effect of applause queued up on his laptop next to it. So he finished the song and he pressed play, and it's like,
I love that.
He's like, thank you very much.
to take a quick shift, one thing I've been thinking about in regards to what's going on is, like, you know, my mom passed away 5-6 years ago, but she was in a strange situation when she passed. She was in assisted living, very anxious. And I often wonder in the last 6 weeks, what would have this been like if she was still around? Like, what have we been doing? How would she have been reacting? And it's a strange parallel to look at. And I know something a lot of people deal with in this time is, like, how to manage their substances. You know, a lot of people are drinking more, doing more drugs, doing things to compensate. That's something you've essentially removed as a crutch from your life for the most part.
And
how do you think, you know, you, Frank, you know, 8 years ago, 10 years ago, certain versions of you that I've come across in my time, like, how do you think that guy is dealing with this?
Not well. I mean, it's funny. I was having this conversation. So I live with my wife in a house now. I used to live for a long time in a flat not too far from here in North London with my buddy Dave Danger, who's one of my very best friends. But that was definitely like our kind of like bachelor flat, for want of a better term. And it was a very messy place in every sense of the word messy. And, you know, it was a pretty chemically altered place from time to time and all that kind of thing. And, like, and it had no outdoor space. And I sort of feel like if this had happened 5-6 years ago when I was still living there, I think that me and Dave either would have, like, killed each other or had sex or both by this point. You know, it's like, it's just
trying to feel something.
Exactly. You know, and it is that kind of thing is interesting to think about. And that brings me on to, like, I mean, I think, like a lot of people, when this first came in, I sort of said to myself, oh, well, you know, it's the great leveler. It's everybody's in this together. And then you realize after a while, when you think about it, that's not remotely true.
Not true. Yeah. You know?
There's a lot of people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, that kind of thing, who are suffering, experiencing very, very different things right now. And not even necessarily that, just like my buddy Chris is one of my best friends. He lives in a flat in Camden with no outdoor space, and both of his daughters kind of came home, and they've got like five of them living in a two-bedroom flat in Camden. Mm-hmm. And I think he's having a fucking nightmare. And he's definitely not somebody who's, like, financially suffering in the, you know, he does well for himself. Right. And yet, you know, his experience and my experience of what's happening right now are pretty different. And that's interesting to me. I feel incredibly grateful, you know, day in, day out for the situation I found myself in when this has happened.
And, like, you know, how's your head? What are some things that, you know, if you used to use something else as a crutch, like, what are the kinds of things you're doing to, you know, relax yourself after you read the news or calm down at night and just be able to take a minute and tune out and relax? Like, what kind of stuff are you using to do that?
Well, I mean, it's It's a funny old thing. Like, I mean, first of all, I do still drink and like, right. You know, we've had some, we definitely sort of, my wife and I have got into a habit of like trying to have like at least 2 days a week where we don't drink because yes. otherwise you just get shit faced every day.
Same.
Yeah. And which is not brilliant. So we've been working on that kind of thing. I'm trying.
It's not dumb, Frank.
It's not
brilliant, but it's, you know, 7 days a week is worse than five. So
yeah,
you know,
yeah, it's true.
It's better. It's better.
But also, like, I mean, I'm trying not to read the news all that much, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, I tend to kind of scan the headlines on the BBC most days to see if there's anything I really need to know, you know? But at the end of the day, I sort of feel like there's not masses of use in me being a news junkie right now. And historically, you know, that kind of thing has not been great for my own mental health, being glued to social media and glued to the news and all that kind of thing. And it's generally speaking a thing that I've been trying to phase out in recent years. So I'm trying to kind of not spend too many hours down my, well, maybe not my laptop because I'm doing a lot of recording right now. But, you know, close the Twitter window, close the Facebook window. Do you know what I mean? Don't
yeah.
waste your time with that shit. I don't think it's healthy. And then I'm reading a lot. I mean, I read a lot anyway, but I've been reading those books I've been putting off. You know what I mean?
Which what kind of stuff are you getting into?
Well, at the moment, I'm reading the new Bill Bryson book, which is amazing. Yeah, but sure. I recently read a 1,000-page agrarian history of Russia in the 19th century, which has been on my bookshelf. I've been shying away from it because I knew it was going to be a monster.
That's a tackle.
And it was.
Yeah,
but I got there. I think the one other thing I would say that I think is really important is that, like, I have good days and bad days. I think we all sure. have good days and bad days, right? You have some days where you get up, you get shit done, you feel productive, you feel like, you know, and I'm writing and demoing a new record at the moment. I'm 16 songs in. I'm feeling really good about the material. But there are days when I start realizing after a while, there are days when I wasn't productive, when I was really down about everything and I get really frustrated. I'm really like upset and scared about the future of my career. Do you know what I mean? Because I have no fucking idea when I'm going to be able to play shows again, which means I have no idea when I'm going to be able to make money again because that is my income. And I'm not going to starve in the short term or get evicted, but at a certain point, that's going to become a major issue.
Yes.
But yeah, so you have good days and bad days. And I think one of the things that I've kind of got into the mindset of as this has gone on is being forgiving with myself for having unproductive days.
Yeah.
If you get up and you're having a day where it's just not landing, it's just not coming together, you know what? Just fucking watch Netflix.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And don't like punish yourself because you didn't get through anything on your to-do list today or you didn't create something new. You know what? It's okay to have a few days where all you do is just sit around in your pants and watch telly.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's an easy thing to forget is, like, you know, it's a strange thing about this not being war or this not being something so tangible, you know, like you can still look outside your window and there's this ominous invisible enemy out there, but things look the same. So you're like, if I'm trapped in the house, I should be doing this and this and this. And it's easy to forget, like, hey, you're in a crisis, you know?
Right,
just,
totally.
Just step back and take a day. Yeah. Wrap your head around it, you know, you'll be all right. Yeah.
Well, yeah, completely. One of my other things that I've been doing, which I would recommend to everybody, is that, like, I've got into the habit of, like, calling rather than texting.
Mm, yeah.
So because you don't see anybody other than whoever you're isolated
for
with.
Sure.
And I'm very fortunate to be isolated with my wife because she's amazing and I love her. But, like, you know, it's just the two of us for a long fucking time now.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, if a friend of mine texts me and says, how you doing? I'll call them back. Or, like, in fact, generally, I'll like FaceTime them back because it's like, it's just good to see people, you know?
Yeah.
And even if it's, you know, through a screen and through the internet and all the rest of it, like in a normal day on a normal part of life, I would sort of just reply to a text with a text and a WhatsApp with a WhatsApp or whatever. And right now I'm trying quite hard to actually go, you know what? Fuck it. First of all, no one's busy. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
but it, you know, just, and even if you just chat for like 5 minutes, just call somebody up. So like, for example, you know, Jim Ward from Sparta. Yeah. So Jim texted me about something random we were working on last year, the other day, and I just called him back. And I was like, what's up, dude? And we had a chat. He was in El Paso. I was in London. And we shot the shit. We caught up. And it was really fucking nice to see his face.
I love that. You know, that actually leads me to some regret. Because I remember we finished the tour together and made a pact to start writing letters to each other. And you actually, like, held up your end. I get home and, like, 3 weeks later, there's a lovely penned letter from Frank that sat on my desk with like the intention of writing back for so long, and then it went away.
I'd completely forgotten about that.
Yeah, so that's my fault. Man, sorry. I forgot,
dude,
too.
It's okay. Well, I don't know about you guys. The postal service is completely fucked over here right now. So it's, okay. Look at us. We're having a conversation right now.
That's true. I guess it's a brave new world. Maybe postcards are purely for nostalgia at this point. But it does make me think of our time in Sweden, our week. Where the week trapped in Sweden. So,
oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So for a little context, this is a fun story because, you know, it was a Gaslit Anthem, Polar Bear Club, Frank Turner tour. It was our first tour together, no? Or
it was second? It was March 2009.
Yeah. And we played in Gothenburg, Sweden, which you would think is sort of a, you know, safe place to be, parked in a hotel. I got a little drunk with our driver, Gunnar Bear, and listened to metal all night. And we woke up to the van being smashed and a lot of gear stolen. Well, not too much gear, mostly merch. Actually, you lost some merch too, right? That was in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, being from the States, we're like, oh, you got to go to the police station, right? And like get a report and, you know, file for insurance, like everything we were used to. So we drive to a police station in Gothenburg. I mean, they couldn't give a fuck. Like, they're like, like, what do you want us to do? I'm like, something? Doesn't something happen? And then we realize, like, we're starting to run late. And basically the plan for that evening was we had about a six-hour drive to Stockholm. We were going to get on a ferry, board a ferry, and take, like, a 16-hour ferry ride to Finland.
To Vastia and Helsinki. Yeah.
Right. Where there'd be a day, you know, basically a day off, then a show, then another day or two of travel, and then back to Stockholm for a show. So essentially, it was like 5 days of that were to go to and from Finland, right? 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
So we realize we're cutting it a little close and we start hauling ass from Gothenburg to Stockholm only to get there. To watch the ferry leave.
The back literally, end of a ferry.
Literally watched it leave. All while staying in touch with Polar Bear Club and Frank being like, hey, don't get on.
If you guys weren't there was no show.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
No, totally. I remember all of this. And then it was like, for whatever reason, the timetables were such that there was no point in us getting on the next ferry because we'd still miss the gig.
Yes.
So we end up facing the situation of we had like 5 days in Stockholm.
Which is the most expensive city. Maybe,
right, totally.
Yeah.
And also, like, I mean, this is the part of the story where it gets interesting, because I have my memories and my version of this, and I'd be very interested in yours. Because for me and Polar Bear Club, there was like six, maybe seven of us in a van driving around, and we had fuck all money. Like, I'm not in any way like being the fucking attitude about this. But like, you know, we're the sport bands. Like, I remember
what we paid.
Yeah. But yeah, so we were just like, shit, what are we going to do? And we got one hotel room.
Yes.
For seven people. Yeah, like, and not a big hotel room, I might add.
No, you guys were sardines. Yeah.
And goddamn, we were all like sleeping on the floor. We were sneaking past the front desk, getting in and out of there. And there is no polite way of saying this. That room smelt like assholes. And like it was miserable. And the thing was, so what we started doing, and I can say this because I'm now a happily married man and this was in the past, but essentially we got into this habit of like, okay, we've got to go out and someone's got to get laid, because if they get laid, that's going to free up some space in the hotel room. You know, and it's like almost everyone was like, boys, lower your standards. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't really matter. It's like whatever's going to make more space in the hotel room. And I'm pretty sure that nobody succeeded.
No, like, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't imagine Polar Bear Club being, I mean, literally the sweetest group of upstate New York boys that you could ever meet. Like the last group of people you would imagine are going to take over a city with sin, you know?
No, completely. And like, it's also just that thing about like, you know, in those days of my life when I was carefree and single and all the rest of it, it's like, if you're trying really hard, it's never going to happen. You know what I mean? And I just have these memories of kind of sitting in like rock bars in Stockholm, nursing one beer for as long as I could make it last, because they were so fucking expensive, and sort of trying to make eyes with every single person in the room. And then completely failing, and then walking back to this shitty hotel room and sleeping on the floor next to like Trevor Bakker's asshole.
Yes. And I remember one night in particular, that you and I had found a reprieve. We basically were like, we were supposed to go out and meet everyone, but we found ourselves alone in a hotel room with a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And we were like, you know what? This is a unique opportunity right now.
Don't leave. The room is empty.
To sit with one other human, have just like a rational human conversation and drink a bottle of wine. And then I remember we went to that, I fell in love with that place, Garlic and Shots, which is literally a garlic bar where their main shot is vodka filled with garlic. But what a nice time.
Which isn't going to help you get laid, incidentally.
But what's funny, even being in Gaslight that time, like I also had no money, especially while we were there.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I do remember, I don't know where you got it from, but you took me to Pizza Hut. And I appreciate that, Frank.
This is why I love talking about this stuff with people, because fuck, man, that was 11 years ago.
You know,
everybody's sort of memories of it are going to be slightly different. One of the other memories from that tour, just briefly, that I love is the guys in Polar Bear Club. God bless them, some of the nicest guys. Yeah. Great fucking band.
100%.
But they were having some internal conflicts.
Yes,
right. And I was riding in their van. I was sort of paying them a few bucks a day for gas and that kind of thing to ride in their van. But as the tour went on, relations were getting pretty low between some members of the band, and their tour manager and driver, Trevor, and I got on super well. And in fact, Trevor's still a very dear friend of mine to this day. And I see him every time we're in Portland where he lives now. The two of us were slightly kind of like sat up front listening to the bickering in the back, because he and I are the same age and the rest of the guys are a couple of years
younger
than us.
And
we felt a bit like sort of parents listening to our kids argue or whatever. And later on in that tour, we went down south, and I think we played in Vienna, and then we had like a travel day, and then we had a show in Milan, I think it was. And I was looking at the map and everybody wanted to kill each other. And the thing was, like, I was the main support on that tour, so I was getting a little bit more money than Polar Bear Club were. And I was doing really well on merch on that tour. I was selling my own merch and I was shifting a lot of shirts, a lot of CDs. So I had some money by that point in the tour. And in the end, what I did was I looked up the map and I discovered that we could go and stay in a coastal resort in the north of Croatia, just on the Italian border, with like a swimming pool and like a beach. And it was cheap as shit. So what I did was, off my own back, out of my own pocket, I went and got everybody in their own room and like didn't tell them where they were going. I put the directions in the sat nav and I was like, just trust me, motherfuckers, we're gonna do this.
Yes.
And we got there and it like everybody just like eased off the gas a little bit on the arguments and it got us through the rest of the tour.
That's gangster. That's some real puppet master work there, Fred.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I felt really good about it. I mean, like I say, this place was literally like 20 euros a night for a room or something. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to spend 120 euros or whatever it was to make sure that nobody murders anyone, because that will be the end of the tour.
Yeah, it was so fun. I remember on those tours too, especially when we were doing particularly like the UK and Germany. You know, there's sometimes, you know, we did it to other bands and then we took some bands out that did it where you're watching an artist play at a certain time and you're like, oh, this is really connecting and this person is going to be much bigger than they are right now. And you were definitely one of those people that it was like pretty clear when it was happening. You're like, oh, there's going to be a time when like we're opening for Frank in England. You know, for sure.
Matt, you know what? Those were my first ever German shows.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. I remember sitting in the backstage of the Underground in Cologne, which was the first show, and thinking to myself, oh my God, no one in Germany is going to get this. They're not going to understand the lyrics. They're not going to understand the references. This is going to be a fucking disaster. And I went on and everybody lost their shit. And it was like, oh, okay, Germany, cool.
Yeah.
Hold on one quick sec, Benny. I just need to interject very quickly. Open Your Ears Records has just released a debut full length from the band called House and Home. It's out right now. These guys are from Richmond, Virginia. Check out the single. Which I don't understand. Consequences for the things that I could never plan. No man's an island, so it doesn't matter where I stand. Cut the lights off, leave the engine running. Yeah, that's House and Home with Shrunken Head. They're single. To get more information and order it, OYERECS.com. That's OYERECS.com. Open Your Ears Records.
So there was a couple stories that I wanted to bring up. because when you graced me with a couple beautiful things in your past, I remembered the Pizza Hut in Sweden, because I gotta remind, Swedish Pizza Hut's not American Pizza Hut. That's a gourmet restaurant. Like, you're right. Sitting down, you're getting a tall, cool beer, you're getting some strange toppings on this thing. Like it's expensive and nice. And then we did another tour in Germany where, you know, Brian Fallon, who for a long time just has notoriously awful teeth, right? Like, he didn't take care of him when he was younger, and it bit him in the ass as an older man. He'll talk plenty about it. I'm not talking shit. And we were in Germany. I don't remember the city. Maybe you could.
I you know what, dude? This was the same tour.
Yeah, same tour. I know.
And we were in Austria, I'm pretty sure. We were in Graz in Austria.
That sounds about right. And Brian, out of nowhere, has to get emergency oral surgery to get an infected tooth out. So, you know, we're in Europe. Of course, they don't believe in real drugs. So Brian essentially, you know, is given like two Tylenols, and then this guy just ripped, I think a woman actually, just ripped the tooth out of his face and gave him again like two more Tylenols and sent him back to the show. This happened right. So we're literally sitting on the side of the stage telling Frank, Brian just got his tooth out. Give us like 10 more minutes.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember being in the middle of the stage and you guys were just going like, keep going. And I was like, I've got to save like a banger for the finisher. Do you know what I mean? So I had like I had photosynthesis held back or whatever. And it was just like, I'd finish a song and be like, is it time? And the audience is standing there being like, why is this support act playing so fucking long?
I mean, and I do think it was like, in the end, it was like a 90-minute to two-hour support slot that you had to do. And we were sitting on the side the whole time, like at an award show when you want someone to talk longer. You know, you're doing that stretchy thing with your fingers.
Doing
that to you from the side. And then Brian walks in, literally, like, his face just, like, swollen and exploded.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a bad...
And I was like, thank you very much.
Yeah, and he doesn't, you know, Brian doesn't drink, he doesn't do drugs. So he just gets up there, you know, somehow gets through like a 70-minute set still, which at the time was shorter than what we were doing. And in classic German kid fashion, we walk outside and they know damn well Brian just got a tooth ripped out of his head. And they were lucky that we even played anyway. And of course, the first thing we hear is, you do not play as long as you normally play. Why is this?
Yeah.
God damn it. Is there anything... You're more consistent than a German, you know?
Like, God bless the Germans. I mean, like, they have no filter, and it's a cultural thing. And there are there are angles on it that I find really, like, admirable and endearing. But like,
I do too.
I remember years ago, it was if not actually my first, like, mainland European show. I was opening for a band called The Levelers, an old British band. And we were playing in... I'm pretty sure it was in Holland, but there was a German guy who'd come to interview them, and there was one big dressing room. And I know the Levelers guys pretty well these days, but back then we'd only really just met. So I was kind of sat in a corner trying to keep to myself. And this interviewer came in, and he sat down with Mark, who's the singer of the Levelers, in a corner pretty near me. And I was like, you know, just trying to read my book and stay out of the way. And the interviewer sat down, put his tape recorder on, and his opening question was, so the Levelers used to be pretty good, now not so much.
The classic.
And it was just like, what the fuck? And the thing is, God bless him, the guy didn't really seem to grasp that there was anything like wrong with the question. And I just laughed my ass off, you know, and Mark just looked like he'd been stung by a bee in the mouth, you know.
There's two things I've realized about Germans in that conversation. One is good and one is bad, okay? So at first, the first couple of years I'm there, I'm like, oh, this is a language barrier, right? You know, they just don't get what I'm saying. I don't get what they're saying. And then after a while, I'm like, oh, no. Like, this is the way they are. And they actually, like, will give you the most brutal, unsolicited advice that you've ever heard in your life. Like, it's horrible. But
I've had long conversations with German friends about this, and they explain that it is a thing. People just talk to each other more honestly there. And, and as I say, there is a level on which I'm kind of like, maybe that's actually a better way to be as a society.
Well, the one thing I'll give to them is, like, it's hard to hear and I don't always enjoy it. But the one thing I'll give to Germans is, like, they're going to buy that record. And then they're also going to buy the next one. And they're going to buy the one after that. It's like... Yeah. It's like they're on the ride with you.
Yeah, so yeah, they're a very loyal audience.
So they almost feel like, okay, this one wasn't so good. What are you going to do next? It's not like we're giving up on you. We're curious. We didn't like this one as much. But you know they're buying your... Yeah, I mean, if how many bands have you seen at German festivals that you didn't even fucking know played anymore? Because they just put out their 13th album and it's, you know, biggest sales point is Hamburg or something, you know?
Totally.
They're just crazy loyal like that.
You know the guys in Fake Problems, yeah?
Of course.
Yeah, so Derek Perry, I did quite a lot of early doors touring with those guys, and Derek's argument winner with me. I love Derek's pieces. We'd have these very friendly, but like quite combative.
He's a brilliant guy in a lot of ways.
He's a very, very smart dude. Yeah. But yeah, we'd have these long kind of debates in the back of the van as we were driving around the US. And if he was ever losing an argument, his ace card that he would pull out, which he regarded as an argument winner, is that Marilyn Manson is still big in the UK and Europe. And he was just like, Marilyn Manson still headlines festivals. Go fuck yourself. And I was just kind of like, I've got nothing.
that was the ender.
Yeah.
I love that. So I have a theory, Frank, that you can help me with. Like, you and Ian Perkins are just like, you know, the most British people I know. So you're the ones I need to dig into this with.
Okay.
Even though Ian's losing his accent, next time you see him, you got to give him shit.
I saw him in Toronto recently and I gave him shit, but yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. He doesn't sound right anymore. But so I've always wondered about like the British cultural cushion with music. Okay, let me explain this.
Okay.
So I feel like some artists, particularly from like the classic rock genre, if they're American, they seem to be put in like a different light than their British counterparts, and their antics aren't really like historically recognized in the same way. I'm talking about, say, like The Doors, Janis Joplin. I feel like it took people until like 2005 to realize the Beach Boys were important. and, you know, and then take somebody like Noel and Liam Gallagher. I feel like if they were American with different haircuts, they're like a laughing stock, you know, and they're not taken as seriously. They're like Good Charlotte. So do you think there's like any truth to what I'm saying? And if there is, like, how could you explain this to me at all?
That's an interesting theory and an interesting question. I think that, like, let me think about this for a second. I mean, like, we're a smaller country is one thing. Also, there's a degree in which, not exactly the same way, but there's a level in which I'd almost say something similar back to you the other way around. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
I would sort of say, like, you know, and this isn't necessarily about classic rock stuff, but when it comes to like punk bands, for example, since 1977, if you want to be a punk band, you want to be an American punk band.
Yeah.
Because like people in this country give way less of a fuck about punk bands that we produce some great punk bands in that time.
Sure.
And they're just sort of taken less seriously. People give less of a fuck. Even like when I was a kid growing up, listening, being into like, you know, Epitaph and Fat Wreck stuff, there was precisely one band from the UK that was part of that scene, which was Snuff.
Oh, yeah.
And Snuff were great, but like that was their unique selling point, was that they were British.
We're the British one.
Like,
yeah.
Wow. You know, and like there was just nobody else in the running. So I guess part of it is just, And it's a funny thing because like my music taste, looking back at it now, I have a rep for being somebody who includes my sort of national identity in my music. That's a shorthand way of putting it. But like, it's a funny thing because my record collection is predominantly American and Canadian. Most of my favorite bands are American. And even just stuff like, you know, for me, it's all about Black Flag, Minor Threat, Dead Kennedys, and then on to like Descendants, NoFX, all that kind of thing. And indeed Nirvana and Shellac and blah, 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 blah. And a lot of kind of great British bands that were around at that time, it took me much longer to kind of tune into.
Huh.
And I think part of that is because, the American band seemed exotic and exciting and all the rest of it. And I guess on some levels, it's sonic taste. But I mean, and speaking of sonic taste, by the way, and I know some people listening to this will not appreciate the sentiment, but I have to be honest, I fucking hate The Doors. God damn it.
I'm with you.
I have to get up early every morning to just have extra time in my day to hate The Doors. Like,
so what is it? So that's almost exactly my point. Is like, I feel like if there was a guy in Birmingham with fucking leather pants and beautiful hair taking his clothes off on stage and walking on cars and saying he was the Lizard King and shit.
Well, that's Robert Plant.
I feel like you guys would have loved that stuff.
That's Robert Plant.
No, he was the Golden God, wasn't Jim Morrison, the Lizard King?
But it's a similar kind of territory.
I see. Okay. Yeah. the guys who stuff sausage into their pants.
Yeah. But then, interestingly, like Zeppelin were always bigger in the US than they were in the UK. Always.
Right.
And similarly, like there's other stuff. Like I was chatting to somebody about this. I think I was chatting to Corey Brandon about this the other day. Black Sabbath were bigger in the UK. Ozzy Osbourne much bigger in the States. People in this country didn't really give that much of a fuck about Ozzy's solo career. He was enormous in the 80s in America.
Right, and in a way,
it felt a little bit like America was like, oh, we kind of miss Black Sabbath. Let's pay attention to this. But it was nowhere near as big a deal in the UK.
So maybe it's simply like a sociocultural thing due to accents, right? So,
yeah.
Like, you know, even in America, I could meet... And this, you know, this is a stereotype I'm willing to let out so people can help me with it, right? I could be talking to a fucking brilliant college professor in Macon, Georgia, and I just deep in my head will go, oh, are they not as smart because of this? And it's not my fault. I'm from New York. I've been bred with certain things. I realize philosophically when I'm listening to this person that they're as educated as anyone else, but there's just like that little thing inside that's like, oh wait, is that a thing? And I feel like British accents just like throughout the world are kind of used in this version of maybe like class and education. Well, and if it's like smarter music and stuff like that, it's taken more seriously.
What that brings to mind for me is the fact that like it's a stereotype and it's true that like if you have a British accent and you're in America and it makes talking to people you're trying to chat up much easier because it's a unique selling point again, like we say. But then on the flip side, like, you know, American friends of mine, when they come to England, most of my female English friends who are single will then kind of get very excited about that.
right.
You know, so... So it cuts both ways. It's interesting that the British accent thing internationally is really funny. Like, first of all, in a way that I don't think happens the other way around, when I'm in America, like every fucker wants to try out their British accent on me.
And
it's like, cool, thanks. It just seems a little bit weird. Do you know what I mean? Like, and then suddenly, like when Americans come to London, everyone doesn't go, oh, wait, check out my American accent. It's just like not a thing you ever do.
That is true.
Yeah.
And for some reason, the default British accents are always either Southerner or like super nerd. Like when Richard Pryor used to do a white guy, like that's the accent for some reason is like over the top nerd white guy.
One of the things that always comes out is the fucking Dick Van Dyke from Mary Poppins, who famously couldn't do a Cockney accent. I'm not even sure if people outside of England know this, but like Dick Van Dyke's accent in Mary Poppins is the worst car crash in cinematic history.
It's worse than Costner in Robin Hood.
Infinitely worse.
Whoa.
And it's funny because like that is the accent that most Americans do when they think they're doing a British accent. And
right, I'm just like, right.
I'm telling you, Dick Van. And the weirdest thing is I'm reasonably sure Dick Van Dyke is English. And for some reason just does this absolute butchering of Cockney.
Just sounds like the Bob Hoskins on cocaine or something.
Yeah, it's just fucking bizarre. The other one like that, actually, and again, I don't know how many people know this, but Frasier, which was a really big show over here, the girl who plays the nanny who gets together with Niles from Manchester, her Manchester accent is a fucking embarrassment.
Is that right? And she's actually from there?
She's not from Manchester. She's from England. But they asked her to do, as far as I know, and I might be wrong about this, but as far as I know, they asked her to do a regional accent for the show. And she did her version of a Mancunian accent. And because it's an American show, nobody went, that's fucking awful. What are you doing? Do you know what I mean? Everyone went, wow, yeah, that sounds authentic. But like people in Manchester are just like, Jesus Christ, what is that supposed to be?
People get confused. They think there's one like universal British accent. I remember I learned... oddly enough, online with Ian Perkins at Graceland, you know, we're in Memphis, we're online, and there's a couple like older British women who are, you know, tourists as well. Ian hears them talk. Of course, Ian being very gregarious starts speaking to him.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, look, we're British people in Memphis. Let's talk. And before you know it, they are fucking taking the piss out of Ian, calling him like a rich, snobby, southern, you know, elite, like, and this is Ian
Perkins.
Which is
Perkins. The last thing I'd ever say about Ian Perkins.
He's like fucking Ali G to me. And these women are just, they're just taking his fucking pants down. It was so funny. And it got awkward fast where you could see like Ian got pissed. They were pissed. Right. Like there was like an obvious
Were they from like Newcastle, Liverpool, or something like that?
They weren't that far north, but they were pretty far north. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. You know, the UK has a lot of accents packed into a small area of the country. I'm a southerner from this country. I grew up in Winchester, which is south of London, even.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember the first time I went to Newcastle and encountered a Geordie accent in the wild for the first time. I couldn't fucking make head or tail of it.
Right.
And, you know, I was a teenager, but nevertheless, I got in a cab in Newcastle and the guy was like, "Hey, you're fucking mad." I can't do a Geordie accent, as anyone listening to this can now tell. And you know, I was just like, what did he just say? I have no fucking idea what he just said. It made me feel terribly kind of middle class and indeed southern.
So that actually leads perfectly into, you know, after what I read is you're performing 2,345 shows or so. It's quite a few. Good for you.
Mm-hmm.
You finally decided to do a live album from Newcastle. Speaking of Geordies.
Yes.
So how did that come about? Was it very pre-planned and was the location planned? How did that go?
So basically, we did this tour last year that was very different from what we usually do. Broadly speaking, the music I make exists somewhere between punk rock and folk music. That's just an oversimplification, but it will serve our purposes.
Sure.
And in terms of the live show that I've been doing, particularly like for the last sort of 6 or 7 years, I've been leaning very much on the punk end of that for the live show. The live shows, you know, it's about energy, jumping off things, getting a mosh pit going, getting the crowd moving, whatever it might be. And that's all well and good, but it's not the only thing that I can do, and indeed not the only thing me and my band can do. And we've been discussing for a long time trying to do a different vibe of show. So we put together this set where we were sitting down, the audience was sitting down. It wasn't quite unplugged because there were some electric instruments on stage, but it was just doing kind of like a folk set, you know? And within that, like the song choices were pretty different from what we usually do.
Okay.
There's a narrative arc to the set list. I'm telling stories. It's kind of an autobiography in a way. And you know, it's in large part inspired by a lot of stuff like, you know, the Loudon Wainwright special on Netflix, which is amazing. And that kind of thing, you know, it's kind of like an evening with kind of vibe. So we did this tour and we did Canada, USA and the UK. And by about halfway through the USA run, like we'd really settled into it. We were in the pocket. It felt really good. You know, at the beginning, I was kind of worried that people were going to leave the show feeling shortchanged because we didn't play Forcible Words and I didn't stage dive and there wasn't a mosh pit.
Right.
And actually it wasn't that at all. Like people were into it, you know, for what it was. So we started recording the shows and we recorded about 25 shows, I think it was.
Oh, okay.
And then at the end of the tour, I sat down and had the extremely tedious task of going through all of those recordings and trying to find the one which at the same time was our best performance, but also with the best rapport with the crowd and the best sound and all that kind of thing.
That sounds confusing.
Right. Well, and also the thing was, you know, I didn't want to do edits. Like it is a live album. That is us playing a show live. We've mixed it, obviously, but we haven't chopped and changed between shows or like re-recorded anything or auto-tuned anything or anything like that. So, for me, if you're going to do a live record, do a fucking live record.
Right.
You know, that whole thing of like retracking stuff or whatever. It's like, just make What's a studio album. You know, apparently, famously, Judas Priest live in Bukidan, the only thing on that record that's actually recorded at Bukidan is the crowd noise.
Is that
they
right?
They retract everything. Which sucks.
That sucks.
So we put it together. I picked the show. My buddy Tristan mixed it. And it's a thing. I think we were planning on releasing it kind of at the back end of this year. But then, you know, everybody's stuck at home.
Yeah, what happened? Something happened?
I don't know. I haven't read the news lately. So we just thought we'd get on with it and get it out. As we're speaking today, it came out today. And I'm very, very proud of it because I think it demonstrates a fair degree of kind of depth for me as a songwriter and us as a band. And it's very different from any other live records I've done in the past or indeed from a lot of the records that I've released too. And some people caught that show, but we didn't go everywhere. We didn't tour Europe. We didn't tour Australia. Yeah. We did a limited American tour. And I wanted it to be documented for everybody to hear. And now they can.
That's awesome. Though one thing I wanted to bring up, since, you know, I'm not sure if it's widely conceived out there, is like how, to me, at least in my eyes, how fiercely loyal you've been to the guys in your band through the years, you know, even advocating for them to be paid in a different way, you know, paid as members of the group. And I think a lot of times, you know, people don't recognize the importance of not only getting people to work, but really be invested in what you're doing. And do you think that if you hadn't approached it that way, you'd be dealing with a different group of guys by now?
Maybe. I mean, it's sort of, it's a symbiotic thing, just in the sense that, like, part of the reason why I wanted to recognize their contribution, both presentationally and like organizationally and financially, was because they had displayed such loyalty to me. Do you know what I mean? It kind of grew together. Like, a lot of the early tours that we did, those guys were getting paid fuck all because I didn't have any money. And, you know, it wasn't immediately like a good career move for any of them from their point of view. And they stuck with me on the understanding that they thought it was going somewhere. You know, and definitely we've had our like difficult moments over the years. I mean, like any band would. It's a slightly different dynamic to a regular band simply because it's my name on the masthead. But like, we've definitely been through some pretty tense moments when it comes to talking about sort of money and recognition and all that kind of thing. But like, just even something like those guys having a band name, The Sleeping Souls, was something that I was really keen for them to do, and let them pick a name. Do you know what I mean? They ended up picking a lyric from one of my songs, and that's cool. But like, you know, and indeed they turned down all my suggestions. I wanted to call them the 1970s because they were all born in the 70s and I was born in the 80s. So it would be Frank Turner in the 1970s. I thought that's a great name for a band.
Yeah, that's
but they
pretty
were
hip,
just like,
actually, yeah. I mean,
yeah, they were like, you're making us sound old, you motherfucker. So we didn't go with that one. But like, you know, it is, loyalty is an important thing to me. And even like my touring crew, you know, there are people on my crew who've been with me for more than a decade. And like, interestingly, like we had a new lighting engineer come in about 3 years ago. And she used to work for a lot of kind of big pop acts. I shouldn't really say who, I suppose, but like, you know, she's worked for some like major league, big indie bands, pop acts, stuff like that. And she sort of said to me reasonably early on, she was like, this is definitely the nicest, most like familial crew I've ever been on. Awesome. And what that meant was that she was like, I want to stick with this, even though we probably can't pay her as much as some other people can pay her. Not least also because of the consistency of the work rate. I mean, obviously that's now a slightly different thing, but generally speaking, like, there are people in bands who will get paid more per day than I can afford to pay, but those are bands that will do 4 weeks of shows a year, you know? Whereas turn around and say to people, look, it's not as high as a day rate, but you're going to be employed all year round. And you know, we've got to a point now where for the musicians of the band, it's a pretty comfortable existence these days. We have a technical crew, set everything up, we drive around, we sound check, we play a show. It's not a bad life.
Now, what would happen? Are they like, you know, I don't know how it works. Are they like legally allowed to go out and play their own show as the Sleeping Souls?
Oh, yeah.
Like, how does that work?
Well, I mean, as the Sleeping Souls, that's an interesting question. I mean, they've been discussing the merits of making a record as the Sleeping Souls with like guest vocalists and every song, which I think is a fucking cool idea.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
But I mean, you know, Nigel has Sad Song Co. Matt does a fair amount of kind of like soundtracky type stuff on his own. And like Nigel, Taran, and Ben are sort of on and off still in a band called Dive Dive that they were in before I met them. And like, I not only do I have no issue with them doing that, I'm all about it. I think it's cool as shit, you know, that sense of people getting out there. The only thing that I really require is kind of precedence. Do you know what I mean? Like, if the fucking Elvis Costello support slot comes in, we're not going to not do it because someone's got like a
bar show.
Because
you have a Dive Dive show. Yeah. Makes sense.
And I don't mean to say that in a way that sounds like belittling to what they do. You know, that's my only real requirement. But like, and you know, the thing is, like, I'm the youngest guy in the band and we've all been doing this. We've been a unit now for like 12 years, including Matt. And Matt was the last guy to join. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time. You know, I hope that everybody wants to keep doing it for a long time, but at the same time, you know, we'll see what happens. But it's funny, like Million Dead, my old band that I was in, we were a band for 4.5 years and we wanted to murder each other for the last 2 years of that. And I do pretty regularly think about the fact that, like, in the grand scheme of things, we're doing pretty fucking well. You know, nobody's stabbed anybody. Like, ever. You know, everybody has their moments. Of course they fucking do. And everybody can, like, bitch about everybody else for at least a solid 24 hours each. But that's the nature of being in a band. It's the nature of being in a family.
Family, yeah, exactly. Now, it's funny you brought up Million Dead. Because I had just read you're working on, you know, some new material. And the quote I'll read back to you.
Oh, shit.
This is you. I'll give you one word, which is aggressive, and we'll leave it there. You know, I did a dance pop record, I did a folk record, and obviously a large part of me is rooted in the world of punk and hardcore, and I'm missing that. So that's all I'm going to say. Well, it seems like you said plenty.
I mean, yeah, I know. I'm such an asshole. That's my attempt to be cryptic.
Yeah, not very cryptic at all. But speaking of which, now that I assume you're making a semi-hardcore record, I know you were a hardcore kid, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
So I just want, like, what's your, like, all-time favorite hardcore record? What's the, or even, like, more specifically, what was, you know, people who aren't into hardcore don't realize the many levels of hardcore you could be into. You know,
sure.
You could be moshcore guy, metal, you know, youth crew. Like what kind of scene did you come out of in hardcore?
Well, so my first real exposure to it was the UK HC scene in the late 90s. And one of the things about that is it was so small that it meant that all of the kind of, like, musical divisions that you're talking about didn't really matter. Do you know what I mean? You'd have bills where you'd have Spy versus Spy, who are straight up braid style emo band, on the same bill as Knuckle Dust, who are sort of old school hardcore, on the same bill as Imbalance, who are like super fast techie, like melodic hardcore. Yeah. You know, it's sort of, there weren't enough people for the scene to splinter beyond that, because there were only like fucking 25 people at a show anyway, you know? So it was a really, really healthy atmosphere and a really nice sort of introduction to all the different corners of it. I guess, personally, I would say my favorite kind of like hardcore without any like prefixes or suffixes records would be the early Knuckle Dust records. They're a London hardcore band. They are still going, actually, funnily enough. But the first two EPs they put out and the first album they put out, Time Won't Heal This, were just like absolutely fucking classic, old school, like kind of beatdowny, but like generally old school hardcore.
Be with a name called Knuckle Dust.
Yeah, totally. Except, of course, they always said that it was like, it's because he's got dust on his knuckles because he doesn't fight anymore. Well, I mean, I'm not sure how much they stuck to that as time went by, because they got quite a lot more tough guy in time. But nevertheless,
a reformed tough guy is more terrifying than a current one, I would say.
But then beyond that, like, my major thing was kind of like the sort of like Boston kind of not quite mathcore, but the stuff that kind of led up to mathcore. So I'm talking about
Converge,
like Butch, Converge, Cave-In, early Dillinger. Sure. You know, adding, you know, stuff like Acme and Neurosis and Catharsis and those kind of bands. That was my absolute kind of passion.
Cool.
You know, and I mean, like, Converge remain one of my all-time fucking favorite bands.
Still up there for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I sort of, Converge kind of spoiled hardcore for me to a degree.
Why is that?
Just in the sense that, like, they're so good that, like, every time I sit down to listen to hardcore, I go over, like, so I listen to this or this, this and this. No, I'm just going to listen to Converge again.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's that's fair.
Yeah. Although, actually, there's a few. Obviously, there's some great bands. I'm really, really into grind. So stuff like Nails and Discordant Axis, Pig Destroyer, that kind of thing, I'm really into. Also, I mean, Kurt from Converge put me onto a band called Knut, who were a Swiss hardcore band from the kind of mid-2000s. Because I know Kurt Little, and he's a lovely, lovely guy.
Yeah,
and
he's cool.
You know, he's in one of my favorite bands. And I sort of was saying to him, like, Jesus Christ, where do you guys get your sound from, kind of thing, in a slightly fanboy kind of way. And he just went, dude, listen to Knut. Oh, okay. So yeah, Knut, K-N-U-T. They're fucking unbelievable.
Alex and I tried to get Gaslight to record with Kurt so many times.
Oh, we did one time. We did.
You did.
We did some B-sides with him. We, in fact, that's one of the main things we did with him was a cover of Somebody to Love by Queen with Kurt from Converge at the desk. It was very fucking strange. It.
And what are your, is there any hardcore bands currently that you're really into, or a contemporary?
You know, I am not super up to speed, I'll be honest with you. Do you know what I mean? Like, I go through phases of kind of paying a bit more attention to what's going on, but I'm the wrong person to ask about what's happening right now. I mean, to be honest, at the moment, I'm like locked into this like death spiral with 70s country. So,
Shit. So what kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been a Merle Haggard fan for a long time, but I've just been getting like super, like the last couple of weeks, I've been listening to a lot of like Doug and Rusty Kershaw, that kind of thing. Like, you know, just like real kind of like FM 70s country, Loretta Lynn. Yeah, that kind of territory.
Awesome. I love that. So we got to wrap this up. I think we're well over an hour. I figured we would have a wonderful conversation, you and me.
I've had the most fun.
Yeah. So I've heard people talking, you know, this doesn't always apply to me because, you know, sometimes I go to sleep stoned. But I heard people talking a lot about in this time with different anxieties and panics, their dreams being a lot different, more vivid, and a little more illusionary to their real life. Have you had any experience with that?
I've been having weird dreams. Yeah. I sort of hope that they're not all that illusionary to my real life. I had this really vivid dream just the other day that Jason Isbell died of a heroin overdose.
Oh no.
And like, I know Jason pretty well. And obviously the whole thing with him is that he's a recovering alcoholic.
Yeah.
And he's sober and he's one of the nicest dudes and he is one of the best songwriters in the world. And it's such an unlikely, this would never happen. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, there is no universe in which this would happen, but it happened in my dream and it was like really stressful. And I was getting loads of calls from journalists to ask to comment about it and all this kind of thing. Oh, and I was like, I don't know what to say.
Oh, my God.
So that didn't happen.
Wow. That's intense.
Yeah, I know. And I sort of woke up being like, did I eat a lot of cheese before going to bed or something? Or like, what the
yeah,
fuck, man?
I don't know if I've ever seen the Jason Isbell chapter of the Dream Journal, but we got to look into this.
Yeah, here it is.
Well, Frank, man, thanks a lot for coming on. I appreciate
it. Dude, thanks for having me, man. And, it's been an absolute joy.
Yeah, I send all my love to you and your people over there.
You know what, man? Like, once this lockdown lifts, I'm going to get... I mean, I've always been a hugger, but I'm going to get super back into hugging.
Oh, dude.
So the next time I see you, I'm giving you a motherfucking hug.
Yeah, when Big Daddy gets his paws on you, I'm going to let that thing marinate for about 90 seconds. You don't worry about that.
You know what? And here's the thing. You know what the sign of a real hug is?
What's that?
A real hug?
Tell me.
Hips touching.
Yes.
You know, when somebody hugs you and then you're just touching shoulders, go fuck yourself. That's not a hug.
That's not it.
That's not it. Hips touching. That's a fucking hug.
100% true. You got to be free to the experience. Yeah. All right. I love you, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Dude, what a pleasure, man. Take it
All
easy.
Right. Bye.
All right. I love it, Benny. I love those stories. Like, I want to just, I mean, I can just listen to tour stories forever, you know. I don't know. I don't know if it holds as much for people that maybe haven't been there, but you know, I always, there's little moments, man, that make, it's not about getting up on stage and playing to people. That's amazing. But like, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think that, yeah. Well, that's the nuts and bolts part of it. I think like, you know, one thing I've come to the conclusion in over the years is a lot of people, when you tell them about a story or you tell them about a situation and they go, oh, like, you're so lucky. That sounds so cool. I want to do that. I wish I could do that. And I think I even said in this interview, you know, like 9 out of 10 people can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, 9 out of 10 people are not willing to disrupt their own life and personal comfort and space and security and all those things enough to even put yourself in those situations. So I think that's where it's unique is like, you know, if you took 6 college kids who have, you know, kind of chosen a more formal path and threw them in Stockholm for a week, the kind of shit they got into, it'd probably be a lot different than what we got into. You know, there's people who are there for the journey, there for the experience, especially in those days when, you know, money is, not always a sure thing, you know, like you got to hang on to the fact that you really believe in your music or really believe in what you're doing or believe in the people around you or else there's truly not enough things to make it worth it.
It's weird because I was actually having a similar discussion with somebody recently and I was talking about how like when I think back to some of these epic tours that I got to do, like the cities are like a blur,
right?
But I can remember I remember all the nights off,
right,
you know, like in weird places or a lot of times the nights off were far and few between, so maybe that's why. But
I mean, I think that's where it's unique. It's like after a while, no offense to these places, you roll into Kansas City
You know, it's like, I've been to this neighborhood. I know what's going on. I'm going to be in the venue. You know what I mean? I got some emails to write. Right. I got to call somebody. Like,
But,
you know, you have an off night. You find yourself, you know, taking cabs around the city,
right,
meeting random people, winding up in strange situations that make you uncomfortable and excited, which are the things that last in your head.
Right.
You know, if, you know, a 6-hour van ride to Kansas City where you just ate some bullshit and you just really want to wash your face and take a shit and then you have to set up your gear. Yeah, I don't know. You start to get used to stuff like that.
Right.
But the night where you meet some local who takes you on a wild ride for a couple hours, I'd always like to say, never follow a hippie to a second location. yeah, I mean, those are the nights, man. And like I said, out of even that situation we're talking about, I barely fucking remember that show in Stockholm.
Right.
I know we played at the Debaser. I know it was a good show, but I don't have any like flashbulb moment of it.
Right.
And I can literally clearly remember eating Pizza Hut with Frank.
Right, right.
So yeah, it's strange. It really is strange. But that's one thing during Corona that I'm trying to remember, especially in the context of my kids. Is like, what are they going to remember right now?
Ugh.
Like, and what are they going to carry from this experience? And I don't think it's going to be those ins and outs and what's actually happening in the day to day. And it's going to be like a feeling.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm trying to like fake it as much as I can in front of my kids. Cause that's like, I think the thing that they're going to remember from this, you know?
Yeah. And that's like, you know, I'm having trouble homeschooling my son. And I don't want this to be his memory to be just like being constantly yelled at about schoolwork.
Right.
So I got to really like, I keep catching myself pulling back, but it's a good point.
Like those are the moments where I'm like, if he picked up anything in this little lesson I just did, if he improved at all, and then we're both getting frustrated, like I'm out.
Right.
Because it's not important enough right now, you know?
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
like he's not writing his dissertation for Harvard.
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you both have to back away for a minute to improve your relationship and make the apartment feel better for a couple hours,
oh yeah,
it's fine.
It's vital.
Yeah, it's fine. You got other shit to do. Put on a cool record. That's music class, you know?
Yeah, we've been doing that. I've been trying to expose
What's the records? What have you been going to?
So I was, because my kids know a lot of good music, you know, especially, I mean, my daughter's 12, but like what I'm trying to do is share like different time periods. So like the other morning I put on 60s era Stones, Rolling Stones, because
okay.
I was like, you know, this is totally different than I think what a lot of people think about when they remember the Stones, at least. You know, when I got into the Rolling Stones, I wasn't listening to that stuff. I was listening to stuff from like the late 70s. And
sure.
But it's important because it's also just a weird, it's cool to listen to that music, man. It's totally different than like Start Me Up, man. Listening to that goofy old, like almost Beatlesque, like pop music.
Yeah, it's like, how many times can one band use a fucking vibra-slap, you know?
So yeah, it's like, it's mainly stuff that they kind of are familiar with, but I'm just trying to give them a different angle on it, you know?
You got to do it. That's music class. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm like, if we're planting something in the garden, that's a class.
Yeah.
Or listening to music, that's a class. If they're painting, that's a class.
Yeah.
I got my son to watch an episode of Treehouse Masters this morning.
Ooh, nice.
You
that's
know?
Fun.
There we go. now I got a woodworker class.
Yeah.
You know?
You're going to have to make a treehouse when this is over, Benny.
Oh, I need a house. But I will. I know how to build one. I love Pete Nelson. That's like my short list of people I want to hang out with is like Redman, Pete Nelson from Treehouse Masters, and I don't know, maybe Will Ferrell acting like Ron Burgundy, like if he never broke character.
I think Will Ferrell and it as anything. I don't think that guy is really ever off, man. I don't think you can be Will Ferrell and not kind of always be Will Ferrell.
Yeah, my Will Ferrell blooper reel on YouTube has been getting me through some dark times recently.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. Anyway,
I'm also
a big fan of Jack Kearney, who just threw us a big wad of cash on Venmo. People are
awesome.
Being very generous, and thank you. We definitely can use this money. I I've said that we're going to relaunch. We weren't going to relaunch Patreon, but I think we might try and give it a shot. We've got some bonus stuff that we could blow out. If we do launch it soon, I'll try and hook up some of these people that have been giving us these large chunks of cash and see if I can get you guys on there, at least for a while. But so I guess just keep an eye out. We'll tweet it out if we do get it going in the next few days or next few weeks. And if so, thank you ahead of time for anybody that might go on there. In the meantime, we're taking cash at Venmo at Going Off Track. If you want to throw us a little bit, it doesn't have to be huge, man. You know, you can give us a buck or two, and you can always give us another one next week or next month. But thank you.
And I feel like for you, Brad, it's more about the emotional stimulus it gives you. Like Jack Kearney, you don't even realize how you add to the beauty of Brad's day.
Well, these people are locking us into this, Benny. I mean, I think we're both kind of like, okay, we're going to keep doing this as long as we can. And now we're like, fuck, we can't stop. These people really care.
Can't stop. Won't stop.
So, yeah, you people are ruining my life. You're locking me into this.
Fuck you, Brad.
No. I'm totally lying. And especially...
You're literally staring at me right now. You know what I mean? Like, what's wrong with your day? It's amazing.
It's beautiful.
Look at these gap teeth staring you in the face.
Love that gap, dude. Love it.
There you go. All right. Well, thanks to everyone. I really appreciate it. Hope you enjoyed Frank episode, and keep an eye out next week for another awesome one.
Yeah.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.